Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Moscow for an analysis of the military situation between Ukraine and the pro-Russian rebels and Russia, which is supplying and supporting the secessionists in eastern Ukraine, who likely shot down a Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777, killing all 298 passengers aboard. Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist, joins us to discuss the unlikely proposition that Vladimir Putin will back down under pressure from the West and sell out his proxies in eastern Ukraine, and the more likely scenario that he will double down militarily as the new Slavophile reactionary politics he has unleashed have Russians in a fevered patriotism whipped up by the avalanche of lies from Putin's propaganda machine. Then we will speak with Masha Gessen in Moscow. She is the author of the scathing biography, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and more recently, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. We will discuss the alternative universe in which, as outrage increases in the rest of the world, Putin's popularity at home continues to rise to an all-time high as the downing of the Malaysian airliner is blamed on Ukrainian fascists, manipulated and managed by shadowy American forces out to humiliate Russia. Then finally, we'll address the ongoing Israeli military offensive in Gaza and its impact on the region with Alastair Crook, a former senior intelligence official with Britain's MI6, who is the founder and director of the Conflicts Forum and a regular contributor to Bitter Lemons International. We'll also discuss the apparently close working relationship Obama has with Putin that may be the only way out of this crisis, although the Ukrainian war seems to be an existential issue for Putin, while Obama is under pressure to escalate the crisis militarily from Republican politicians like John McCain, who called Obama a coward. And joining us now is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005, Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joins us from Moscow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Hello, thank you.
And do you agree, Dr. Felgenhauer, that there's a sort of symmetry here, that Vladimir Putin is under pressure from his right, if you will, to escalate and this crisis, and that Obama is also under pressure, as we know from statements from Senator McCain and others, that he's a coward and he's not stepping up and he should put boots on the ground in Ukraine and the Baltics. Do you think this situation is likely to escalate?
Well, yes, that's rather possible. There are a number of kind of points that has to be held in mind in this very fluid situation. There's a real threat that the pro-Russian separatist rebellion in Donbas may collapse militarily. They are kind of hovering on the verge of that around, and this is unacceptable for Moscow and for Vladimir Putin. Though the Kremlin obviously, at least in April, decided not to go in for a full-blown invasion of Ukraine proper, hoping that this could be avoided, and with it maybe the punitive sanctions that the West has threatened can also be avoided. But the collapse of the rebellion is not acceptable. So Russia is doing what it takes to ensure that the separatist enclave in Donbas survives, which means there's a need to kind of have a military balance in the field. Though both sides are mostly amateurs fighting and not that well organized forces. But the Ukrainian forces have a bit of an upper hand, and a lot of that upper hand is their air superiority, because the fighting is happening mostly in the Don steppes in the summer, when air superiority is one of the most important factors. And a lot of fighting, the real strategically important fighting, is happening not in cities in Donbas, but out in the open in the border area, where the Ukrainians are trying to cut off the supply lines of the rebellion. If their supply lines to Russia are cut, from Russia they get men and material and munitions and everything, the rebellion most likely will collapse. Russia has been introducing increasingly more heavy weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons. And this is actually an attempt to balance the situation, because for the Kremlin right now, most likely the best way out is a frozen conflict, a lasting ceasefire. But a military balance for that should be achieved. The Ukrainians' air power has been not only just simply attack aircraft, helicopter gunships going in, but also supply dropped by parachute by Ukrainian transport planes to some Ukrainian units that are right now kind of sandwiched between the Russian border and the rebel forces. And it's very important for the survival of the rebellion that these air supplies should be stopped. So apparently that's why the rebels got those Bukhor SA-11 high tire anti-aircraft missiles to maybe shoot down several transport planes and scare off the Ukrainian pilots for them not to stop those supply missions. The Malaysian passenger plane was flying in from the west towards the Russian border, basically how the Ukrainian transport planes fly in. Maybe at a higher altitude, but maybe the crews that were operating the SA-11 Buk M1 missiles didn't figure that out. They have a kind of radar that takes a rather short sector. And so that was just a bleep on the screen. And then already, of course, the missile flies on its own. It's self-guided home. So I believe this was sort of unpremeditated manslaughter, a tragic mistake, what happened.
But Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, are you alone in this analysis in terms of the media in Russia? Because my understanding is that the opposite is being said, that the Ukrainians tried to shoot down Putin's aircraft, and it's these Ukrainian fascists did this.
Well, yes, right now the Russian bureaucracy went into traditional Russian bureaucratic denial. They're caging in. They're denying everything. They're spreading totally ridiculous lies. There's a kind of, psychological difference between Russian society and the West. In Russia, lying is not considered a serious offense of morality, and actually everyone expects that everyone else is lying, especially government officials. And for an official in Russia to say a lie, it doesn't disqualify him in any way and doesn't impeach him. Putin said in the beginning of March that Russia does not want you in Crimea. In a couple of days, we annexed Crimea, and no one blushed and no one actually considered that a big deal. That's why lying seems very different. I would believe that most likely the better path for Moscow would be to accept a responsibility in what was done wrong, if it was done wrong, as I believe, and that would be much better, because in previous such engagements, like with the Korean Boeing 007 flight in 1983 near Sakhalin, which was downed by the Russian Air Force, when really Russians, the Soviets, got as castigated by the international community when they were caught lying, or like in the Cuban missile crisis. I mean, being caught lying, I mean, in the West, an official saying an outright lie is not considered, is considered, well, really a disaster. It's different in Russia. And that's a big mistake, because one thing is a manslaughter, unpremeditated, and another is a premeditated cover-up, what is happening right now. That's another very grave mistake, which is putting Russia in very serious harm's way, and that's a real crime.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences from 1994 to 2005. He published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joins us from Moscow. So, but my understanding, though, is that this is an existential crisis for Vladimir Putin, that he has started this project, this Novaya Russia, the new Russian project, and he's riding high in the polls. So is it at all likely that he would take your advice, which, you know, presumably would be intelligent advice, from what I can tell?
I'm afraid not, because after Vladimir Putin annexed Crimea, he destroyed, the capability of his government machine to back off. I mean, he can put on the brakes, he can kind of move more swiftly forward, he can stop it as he did in the end of April, when everyone obviously were preparing a massive invasion into Crimea, into Ukraine, and it was called off. But, I mean, okay, he right now says, you know, those guys are lying, they shot it down, I will punish those who were involved, I mean, this is a terrible crime, we'll get to the bottom of it. But then the West will say, okay, that's very good, and now return Crimea. And he can't return Crimea. And if he can't return Crimea, that means sanctions will be there, and no more sanctions will be added. So with Crimea annexation, I don't see any back-off strategy, back-out strategy for Russia right now, for Putin. For Russia, yes, but most likely already after Putin. So I'm afraid this advice will not be heeded. Of course, in 1983, first the Russians said, no, we didn't do anything with that Boeing, we didn't shoot it down. Then the then Russian leader, Yuri Andropov, said, no, okay, we shot it down. That was a kind of singular admission, because mostly the Russian, as the tradition of Russian bureaucracy for centuries, has been to deny in the face of anything.
Well,
and call it all an enemy provocation.
But will Putin give up on destabilizing eastern Ukraine if, as you say, the Ukrainian military are making advances and that the rebels' forces are disintegrating, and that's why the Russians up the ante by supplying more sophisticated military equipment, which apparently has backfired? What's your just sense of whether or not how is he going to give up on supporting the brethren in Ukraine against these fascists organized by the West? I mean, I'm being sarcastic.
Is not the brethren for Putin, at least. Putin wants to keep this Novorossiya even in the form of a very small enclave, but keep it secure as a kind of frozen conflict, say like the Transnistria conflict in Moldova or Abkhazia or something, because the Kremlin wants to control Ukraine. The Kremlin wants to ensure that Ukraine does not become an ally of the West, that Ukraine will be under our control. And having kind of unrecognized entity in the territory of Ukraine is the best way to control it in a frozen conflict situation, because we can tell Kiev, if you behave, then we will not recognize their independence, we'll support them less if you behave, if you don't behave, we're going to support them more, we will recognize their independence. And so this gives a good leverage over Kiev. It also gives a leverage over the unruly Donbass rebels. But so that would be right now an ideal situation. So Putin's all the time saying, let there be a ceasefire, a continuous ceasefire, continuous negotiations, which may continue till hell freezes over. Because that would be the best way. But a military defeat, a collapse of the rebellion, that's unacceptable. That means we're going to anti... Right now, Moscow is not on the... not ready for a full-blown intervention, because Putin is a very, well, a person who seldom takes serious risks. But if it comes to that, that even that is possible somewhere down the road. Right now, we're in the second half of July. It's August, beginning of September. That's the best time for warfare in those places. The ground is dry to move tanks. The skies are blue to use aircraft. Come autumn, and Russian capabilities to perform any offensive action will be seriously downgraded. Well, so now is the most dangerous time of the year.
Well, just in
speaking.
But just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, at this point, do you think the situation has disintegrated into a kind of similarity to the Yugoslav war, where the Ukrainians and the Russians are acting like the Serbs and Croats, and the extent to which the level of cruelty and hatred between the sides is likely to increase, and the bitterness? And my understanding is that there's not an awful lot of support for the Donbas rebels within the East. People there don't want war on their territory. That's obvious.
Well, some do, some not. I just recently discussed this with the Serbian ambassador here in Moscow, and I said that this is very like Ukraine. There was such a thing, sounds like Ukraine. It's the same in Slavic. Ukraine, Srpska Krajina, Knin. That was part of Croatia that had a war with Croatia in 92. They created a self-styled republic in 95. After a long ceasefire, the Croatians built up a military capability. In 2 days, they took Knin and destroyed the Srpska Krajina. And the Serb ambassador told me, yes, it's very much the same. And he knows it much better than you guys in the United States, because, well, somewhere did serve in the former Yugoslavia, but, I mean, those guys lived there through that conflict. Yes, there are many similarities.
Well, that doesn't bode well.
In Donbas and Srpska Krajina in Croatia.
Well, that certainly doesn't bode well for the future, does it?
Well, the future seems very dim, I would say.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences from 1994 to 2005. Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local international publications, and he joined us from Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Masha Gessen from Moscow.
Really knock me out, leave the West behind, and move on, girl.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Moscow is Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist who has been described as Russia's leading LGBT rights activist. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Ranter, and Slate, among other publications. And Masha has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and her latest, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And she is currently working on a new book about the Sanarov brothers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Masha Gessen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And our previous guest, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, explained what he thinks happened in vis-a-vis the military aspects of this Malaysian airliner being shot down. He said that the Donbas rebels are pretty much in a state of collapse under attacks from the Ukrainian military, neither of whom are particularly professional, he said, but there are pockets of Ukrainian soldiers on the Russian border who are trying to stop supplies crossing the border to the rebels, and that these Ukrainian transport planes are used to parachute supplies into these besieged pockets of Ukrainian troops and to up the ante. Russians supplied the rebels with these missiles in order to shoot down these transport planes. I know that is not what's being reported in the Russian press, but does that make sense to you?
That makes sense. That's very similar to what the State Department has said, which has been the most in the statement issued today. That's been the most comprehensive and the most logical narrative that we've seen of what happened. And at this point, nobody but the Russian television channels is arguing with the fact that the missile came that it was a missile, and that the missile came from the ground, and that it came from the areas controlled by so-called separatists.
But then if that's not getting through, and if the narrative on the Russian media is that the Ukrainian fascists shot it down, they tried to shoot down Putin's plane coming back from Brazil, and that the Ukrainian fascists are being manipulated by these dark, shadowy American forces, if that's the narrative that's playing there, what about, though, the human aspect, which apparently has outraged the Prime Minister of Malaysia and the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, both of whom called Vladimir Putin, apparently had a fairly contentious conversation with him because of the disrespectful nature of leaving these bodies to rot in the field while their wallets, watches, iPhones, and duty-free liquor was looted by these so-called rebels.
Well, I see nothing surprising about this for two reasons. One is that every time in recent Russian history, and actually not so recent as well, but that we have seen a human tragedy, we've also seen this barbaric approach to the dead, and we've seen looting. We saw that during a theater siege in Moscow 11 years ago now. When not only were people who were removed from the theater left on the stairs of the theater, and that is why 139 people died at the time, but also their things disappeared. The bodies had been cleaned of their wallets. The things that they had left at the theater in the cloakroom had disappeared. So the security forces at that time, you know, the actual identifiable Russian security forces that theoretically are accountable to somebody, unlike these so-called separatists, even they had no qualms about looting the dead after a terrible tragedy. So I'm not at all surprised about this. I mean, there's actually accounts going back to World War II of the Russian army behaving like this, both while liberating European countries from the Nazis. So there's looting, there's rape, there's marauding. We've seen a lot of that. And it's certainly not surprising that it's happening in this situation, because not only is it part of the culture, but also these people are not answerable to anybody. I mean, with Putin, the situation that Putin has engineered in eastern Ukraine is a situation of purposeful destabilization, of the purposeful removal of any kind of identifiable authority. He has purposefully placed thugs in charge and let them roam. And I think this is exactly the result you would expect if you're placing thugs in charge, giving them missiles and telling them that they have control. They're running eastern Ukraine like they would run a prison.
But Masha Gessen, surely the Russian people would not want to be portrayed in the rest of the world and seen in the rest of the world as you know, desecrating bodies and being completely insensitive. I thought there was this concept in Nikol Turney, the idea that you don't want to appear uncultured.
Well, that is a nice word, Nikol Turney, but two problems with that. One is that the Russians actually feel no responsibility for what's going on in eastern Ukraine. I mean, they don't see those people, I think the Russian public doesn't see those people as Russian. They see them as people they would support. They want to have eastern Ukraine. They want to support these so-called separatists, but they don't identify with them. So they don't see that it reflects on Russia. The way they're behaving. That's one thing. The other thing is they don't know what the rest of the world thinks of them. They know that the rest of the world is filled with enemies. It's filled with American propaganda. It's filled with homo fascists. And why would they care what the homo fascists who are trying to shoot down Putin's plane think of them? And finally, the marauding and the looting is not being reported on Russian television. What's being reported on Russian television is this conspiracy theory about Ukrainians shooting down a plane.
Again, I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, who is in Moscow. She's a Russian-American journalist who has been described as Russia's leading LGBT rights activist. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granter, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob, and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and she's currently working on a new book about the Sanarov brothers. So, Masha, then what is one of the things I also spoke with Pavel Felgenhauer about, and he said he just met with the Serbian ambassador to Moscow, and I brought up the idea that there's so much hatred and bitterness because of the cruelty and fratricide that's gone on in this war, that it looks as if the Russians and Ukrainians are becoming like the Serbs and Croats. And apparently the Serbian ambassador agreed that was the scenario. So could it really become so bitter that it becomes intractable?
I think it's probably already there, and if it isn't, we're going to get there very, very soon, unfortunately. Again, we're dealing with a situation where the Kremlin has been in full control of broadcast media for more than half a generation now, since the year 2001. So, it's like having the ability to beam a message directly into the brain of every Russian. Broadcast media reach out to 98% of the households. And the messages that are being beamed into these brains 24/7 are messages of hate towards Ukrainians, and that's really scary because they're whipping up anti-Ukrainian fervor, but they're also whipping up just naked aggression, naked militaristic fervor, and I don't think that this aggression is going to stop with Ukraine, because Putin has no choice but to keep escalating this. He is completely addicted to his growing popularity rating, which has only grown more since the downing of the plane. And in order to keep the rating growing, or at least to keep it even, he will have to continue to escalate. And at some point, Ukraine is simply not going to be enough. There are going to be other objects of hate and other objects of aggression.
So that's the future. I mean, and what's happening with the opposition? I take it that the laws that Putin has passed to suppress dissent, since he was so shocked by the enormous outpouring of protests to his giving himself another term as president, that he's criminalized any political protest to the point where it's cost you a year's salary to speak out or hold up a placard on a street corner.
That is true. It's actually even worse than that. What they have done is they have created a system of laws that are designed to be applied selectively and almost randomly, so that obviously they're not going to send everybody who protests to jail. But the risk of an ordinary protester, or even somebody who, say, reposts a Facebook call for a demonstration, the risk of somebody like that, just a very rank-and-file participant, suddenly ending up in jail is tangible. So they've raised the stake hugely for protest. And at this point, it's becoming similar to the situation that we had in the Soviet Union, where simply speaking out, while not guaranteed to bring extreme punishment, could bring extreme punishment. They also continue to adopt new laws. There are laws going into effect in just over a week, in just over 2 weeks, that will, if the Kremlin is inclined to, facilitate the closure of social networks such as Twitter and Facebook on Russian territory. Eventually, they will also close down access to services like Gmail, Skype, anything that's hosted outside of Russia. So these laws are designed not only to discourage and punish protest, but also to continue to isolate the Russian public in ways, again, that take it back to the past. And I think that this the downing of the plane will inevitably be used to justify more restrictive laws. That's what's happened every time there has been a major catastrophic event in recent Russian history. It's been used as pretext to pass further restrictive laws, and I'm sure that's going to happen this time as well.
How ironic that the revelations of Edward Snowden, who is Putin's guest, he's been his stay in Moscow has been extended, that his revelations are being used by the Kremlin to domestic spying here in the United States, to used by the Kremlin to basically destroy internet freedom in Russia.
I mean, it's funny, but it's a funny footnote because they'd be doing this no matter what. I mean, I don't think Snowden is instrumental in this. I think that unfortunately that kind of association and the way that Snowden has allowed himself to be used has served to discredit him and some of the very important information that he has revealed in the United States. But you know, I don't think he's an important influence on Russian ideology.
No, but the idea that Putin's arguing that the Americans control the internet, they invented it, and you know, one of the fallouts from the Snowden revelations has been enormous damage has been done to U.S. High tech companies with their cloud services. Nobody around the world trusts them, so brand America has suffered. So but the point I was making, ironically, is that internet freedom in Russia is all but extinct. So anyway, yeah. I didn't mean to get off on that tangent. Just in closing, Marcia Gessen, then I got nothing but pessimism from our previous guest, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who said that the current conditions, weather conditions, are ripe for military operations. The ground is hard for tanks. The sky is clear for planes, etc. It could get worse. What you're in Moscow? What's your sense of how things might proceed? Notwithstanding that, apparently President Obama and President Putin do have a good working relationship. They speak a lot on the phone. However, Obama is being accused by Senator McCain of being a coward. So he's being pushed to the right by hawks over here. And I imagine the same is happening with Putin.
Yeah, I don't think that President Obama and President Putin have a good working relationship. I think that the fact that they have been talking on the phone, and in fact that Putin has been talking on the phone a lot with various Western leaders, is not necessarily a good sign. It's certainly a sign that he is faced with a difficult situation, and he realizes this. But in his case, long telephone conversations are usually a sign that he continues to sort of keep saying the same thing over and over again without hearing his interlocutor. And repeated telephone conversations actually point to the same thing. So I don't think that there's any reason to believe that they're getting anywhere with these conversations. I do think that Putin realized the situation is very difficult. I very much doubt, however, that he will find that he will see in this an opportunity for an exit, because as he takes measurements of sort of his popularity rating, his media, I don't think he will find an option for an exit. I think that the only option he will ultimately find is escalation. So I think there is a brief period of deliberation, so there's obviously a non-negligible possibility of his looking for an exit, but I think it's very remote.
Well, Masha Gessen, I thank you so much for joining us from Moscow.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Masha Gessen, a Russian-American journalist who has been described as Russia's leading LGBT activist. She is the author of the scathing biography, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and her latest book is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and she's now working on a new book about the Sannara brothers. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former senior MI6 intelligence official, Alastair Crook, who was recently the foreign policy advisor to the head of the EU.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alastair Crook, who is the founder and director of the Conflicts Forum, which works for engagement between political Islam and the West. And he's also a regular contributor to Bitter Lemons International. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alastair Crook.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to talk to you both about the Russia-Ukraine crisis and the Israeli military assault on Gaza underway. It does seem in both cases there's a peculiar symbiosis. In the case of Gaza, apparently Israel's foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman, in a cabinet meeting, basically accused Netanyahu of not having the cojones, as they say in Spanish, to take on Hamas. And here in the United States, we have Senator McCain, who apparently has never gotten over his defeat in 2008 by Barack Obama, is calling President Obama a coward. So it seems to me that there's a real possibility that the Ukraine situation could get worse, because it seems for Putin it's an existential situation in terms of having brought up these politics of greater Russia. And on the American side, the hawks over here are determined to push Obama to the right.
I think it's actually a very good metaphor that you just produced. And in fact, it does work for both ways. Clearly, President Obama is somewhat vulnerable in terms of his foreign policy, in that people on the right and in the parties have claimed that he hasn't been sufficiently assertive in foreign policy, has not been sufficiently aggressive. And of course, in a sense, Russia is an enemy that everyone loves to hate in Europe and in America. I don't quite know why, but it's the Ukraine affair has brought forth deeply buried, latent sort of hostilities, both to Russia and to Putin personally, both in Europe and America. But I think more than that, the president has elections, midterm elections coming up in November, again, where he feels that he'll be vulnerable on foreign policy, and also in the sense that he needs to try and to show that he's a commander-in-chief and has not lost control of foreign policy. I think most of the other elements of his foreign policy, whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or whether it was an agreement with Iran, all of these have been rather elusive in this time. But in the same way, too, all of the chat shows, all of the main public broadcasting in Russia are saying or questioning whether Putin is not also being less than assertive. There have been strong calls, a real outrage for what the Kiev government is doing to the civilians and the people of eastern Ukraine. And indeed, you said it's existential, but it's more than that. It's actually family. And this is what makes the Ukraine so important and so difficult. You recall that Mrs. Thatcher went to war for the relationships that existed between the Falkland Islanders and Great Britain. But this is much more. I was recently in Moscow, and you could barely meet a Russian that doesn't have family in Ukraine. I mean, they are very, very closely knit. And Ukraine was culturally, and in many ways, the cradle of Russian civilization. So it's a very strong and very powerful link. So he also has a sense in which if the assaults on the Russian speakers and those people in eastern Ukraine who are looking for a looser federalism or autonomy continue and the bloodshed rises, then he will be under enormous pressure also to prove his toughness. I mean, he's in a different position from Obama in this respect, in that his popularity is extremely high, very high, nearly 70 to 80%, whereas Obama is in a different position in that respect. But I think both of them also quietly would like to see this thing de-escalated and brought down and quietened. And they have both people in both of those governments who would like to see it escalate and perhaps even escalate to the point of a conflict. So I think there is a great similarity between the two sides, and I think this is why the real only prospect for avoiding that escalation is if they can find some sort of agreement between them to wind down the language, to wind down the hostilities, and to find a political element. But in this recent period, what we've been seeing is actually the opposite. Whereas we've seen the French president and also Angela Merkel having teleconferences with Poroshenko to try and bring about a new ceasefire, he seemingly has been getting messages from some elements within the administration urging him to pursue the attacks in East Ukraine. So, you know, in both areas, it's very complex. Both presidents are under very powerful dynamics and pressures internally, as well as the danger of being in an event that is totally unpredictable, such as when we saw the downing of this airliner with the tragic loss of life. But all of this is something that can explode a situation and turn it into something very much more dangerous.
Again, I'm speaking with Alistair Crook, who's the founder and director of the Conflicts Forum, which works for engagement between political Islam and the West, and he's also a regular contributor to Bitter Lemons International. But it does seem, though, that in many ways this conflict is starting to mirror the Yugoslav War, with the Ukrainians and the Russians looking more like the Serbs and Croats, in the sense that the level of cruelty and hatred between the two sides is increasing. And you know, obviously, this situation should never have got to the point where it did. And I think in many ways you can say the same about Gaza, because back when the election took place that brought Hamas into power, the Bush administration and Condoleezza Rice weren't watching the store. And in this case, in Ukraine, it seems like Victoria Nuland, this neocon in the State Department, was running the show. And they pushed this situation into a corner in terms of giving the Ukrainians, or forcing on Yanukovych, although he was a manifest criminal and a kleptocrat, forcing him into a corner, and thus the chips have fallen the way they have. Would you hold Obama responsible for not watching the store and for allowing, you know, the Poles and the Czechs to push the envelope too fast and too hard?
I think it took him by surprise, and I think in that context, yes, obviously, the president is always responsible or should be responsible for what goes on in his administration. But I think that probably when the history books come to be written about his administration, I think one of the biggest questions will be his aim at the outset to create this team of rivals, of bringing people who are so ideologically opposed to the type of foreign policy he stood for into his administration, and indeed allow them to hold prominent positions. So that whereas he is being, in a sense, trying to end wars in the Middle East, I mean, there are various people who've been very, very much within his administration, not just in the opposition, who've been horrified that he didn't attack Syria, who disagree profoundly with the initiative towards Iran. It's not reflected in American public opinion, but there are many people who still feel animosity towards Iran and doubt the value of the approachment to him. And I think he was taken by surprise and pushed into a corner by people who disliked particularly the fact that Syria did not work out as they'd hoped, precisely because the president had a relationship with Putin. And as you recall, the outcome of this was achieved by having the agreement to dismantle the chemical stocks held by Syria. And many of them were very bitter about that and felt this was wrong. So there's been an attempt, I think, for some time to try and undermine the president's relationship with President Putin and to wrong foot him on these key areas of foreign policy. And Ukraine provided the perfect place to, if you like, put him into a corner, and put him into a corner from which it was very difficult to walk anything back. And I think with the press very much in generally, both in Europe and in America, who hostile to Russia and to Putin personally over what happened in Ukraine, it's been very hard for him to do that, particularly at a time in the lead up to elections. So I think it's going to be very hard to see whether both these two presidents are going to be able to find a way to de-escalate it. So far, President Putin has had some success in splitting off some European countries from the United States, principally Germany, but also others, France, Italy, Belgium, and other countries who have not been willing to go along with it and who've been questioning the rationale for escalation with a major European state like Russia. So I think Putin has been playing the diplomatic game quite well. But, of course, then you have the potential game changer of the downing of a civilian airliner, and who, with no clear indication at this point about who might be responsible for firing, if indeed it was the missile that finally brought it down.
Well, Alistair Crook, that aside, and there does seem to be some fairly mounting evidence that it was a Buk missile system that had been supplied by Russians. There's been some intercepts as well, the veracity of which is yet to be determined. But the one thing that we can say is that many of the European leaders, including particularly the Dutch leader, are just outraged by the inhumane and disrespectful way in which the remains of these victims have been allowed to rot in the fields, with some of these drunken soldiers looting the duty-free packages of liquor, stealing the wallets, the watches, the iPhones, etc. I mean, on a humanitarian level, this has left you feeling as though these people that are in eastern Ukraine are not exactly a noble bunch, and that I don't know the extent to which Putin has lost control of them or has control over them to begin with.
I don't think he ever had. I mean, I think this was a figment to suggest that there was control. We simply do not know who. I mean, it's questionable whether Russia is adamant that it never supplied these surface-to-air missiles to the Donbass rebels. It is true that they have said that they had captured one of these missiles, but whether it was able to be activated. These are sophisticated. This isn't shoulder-held missiles. This is a mainstay weapon which requires radar guidance to function. And it's not very clear who is responsible. There was also Ukrainian army missiles, the same type, in the same area whose radar was switched on. We know that from they were picked up. Again, it's not, Ukraine has in the past brought down an airliner by mistake. So it's not entirely clear, and I think the great mistake is to jump to conclusions before we hear finally the evidence. My own feeling is that, in fact, Ukraine being on the borders so close to Russia, the Russians will have their military air control, which is very, very sophisticated in terms of its radar and its systems for detecting any form of radar in the area or any form of flight. Don't forget, also, President Putin was flying the same route within 30 minutes of the downed airliner. So it's quite clear that they must have quite a lot of information on their military air control system. And I think really what Putin is trying to do at the moment is trying to broker a real investigation of what happened and its context, rather than simply have everyone jump to conclusions. Of course, what you say is true. I mean, I think any disrespect for those killed in this tragic way is terrible. But, you know, I always try and point out, I mean, it's so easy for us living in stable and secure societies to say these things. I've spent most of my life in areas of conflict, and I really, you know, unfortunately, quite often one sees these things, the hatreds, the anger, the sense of despair sees people, and they do things which are not necessarily very rational. But that is the consequence of deep conflict, unfortunately.
Well, Alistair Crook, you mentioned before in a previous interview that contrary to conventional wisdom, Obama and Putin do have a good relationship. They speak often on the phone. In fact, they were speaking on the phone when Putin first mentioned the downing of this aircraft to Obama, and that this relationship, of course, will be put to the test at the moment. In terms of the other crisis in Gaza, obviously, Obama does not have a good relationship with Netanyahu, and nor did many of the predecessors, particularly Bill Clinton, in his first meeting with Netanyahu after Netanyahu left the Oval Office. Clinton turned to his aides and said, "Who is the effing superpower here?" So what's your sense of whether that can be wound down, or is this just, you know, somebody said the other day, this is the Israelis mowing the lawn, and then they'll, you know, retreat, and then we'll go back to the status quo ante?
I think there are two elements. I think what you say is absolutely right about the situation. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu wished to use an unfortunate killing of youth for two purposes. Firstly, to remove the infrastructure of Hamas in the West Bank, and also to prepare the public for one of these, if you like, periodic mowings of the lawn in Gaza. But I think what is slightly different in this occasion is two things. I'm not sure how much it will change, but we will see. Firstly, I think that the Gazans, in terms of the military wing of Hamas, have learnt a lot from the 2006 war that broke out between Israel and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. It was essentially a war of tunnels. It was a war of keeping rockets firing despite aerial bombardment, not because the rockets were intended to, if you like, defeat the enemy or bring it to submission, but precisely to bring the enemy having to put boots on the ground. They had to do that in South Lebanon, and now very tentatively Israel is having to put boots on the ground in Gaza. And the purpose of that is that once it goes onto the ground, the strategic situation totally changes. You'll have troops going into a refugee camp of 1.5 million looking for a few bearded men who are the leaders of Hamas. It's more than a needle in the haystack. It's almost an impossible operation. Narrow alleys, booby traps, snipers. It's a completely different military situation where all the advantage of a technological army effectively disappear almost immediately. Air cover becomes much less effective, much more difficult to manage when you have your troops on the ground, particularly in the crowded confines of a refugee camp. So I think this is what we've seen. We've seen them using tunnels already to kill two soldiers. And they have been continuing to fire the rockets despite the heavy bombardment that has been produced. What I think is also striking is, again, similar to South Lebanon, in fact, almost no casualties amongst the leadership of Hamas. The Israeli Air Force has resorted to bombing the homes of some of the leaders, but they haven't been able to find any of the leaders, who are probably, like their Hezbollah counterparts, well buried beneath 40 meters of ground out of reach of the bombing attacks during this period. So I don't know what will be the outcome of it, but I think it's not going to be easy to wind it down at this stage. Maybe when we see how things develop, then it will get to a point where a ceasefire is possible. But having been responsible for negotiating and or participating in negotiations for these types of ceasefire in Palestine when I was working for the EU foreign policy chief, you have to have the right moment to put them into effect. And at the moment, I don't think either side is ready to back down. And I don't think that in these instances like Gaza, either the pleadings of European leaders or indeed the pleadings of the American leadership will really weigh very heavily, not at this stage. I think it will be something where there's a trial of strength, and until that trial of strength becomes a bit more apparent and who's winning and who's not, only then will we start to see a ceasefire coming into position. I know it sounds a little bit pessimistic, but I've been dealing with ceasefires in the Middle East for nearly 25 years or so.
Well, Alistair Crook, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your program.
And again, I've been speaking with Alistair Crook, who's the founder and director of the Conflicts Forum, which works for engagement between political Islam and the West, and he's a regular contributor to Bitter Lemons International. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.